First of the headlines, at least three rockets hit a military base at the Iraqi capital's international airport, which houses US troops. Israeli forces clash with Palestinian protesters in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, wounding at least seven of them. And activists slam US police brutality and racial profiling during a funeral for a black man killed by a white officer in Minnesota. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iraqi security officials say at least three rockets have landed in the perimeter of Baghdad International Airport. The officials said the rockets struck near the area of the airport, which houses US forces. No damage or casualties have been reported. There was no immediate claim of responsibility either. On Sunday, five rockets targeted an Iraqi airbase located north of Baghdad that hosted US soldiers and warplanes. U.S.-led facilities, forces, and supply convoys in Iraq have repeatedly been targeted in recent months. Anti-American sentiments are running high in the Arab country after the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis in January last year. The Iraqi parliament then voted for the withdrawal of American troops from the country. Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says under international law, the Iraqi people have every right to resort to force to remove the occupation.
Well, the Iraqi people have every right to do this because under international law, occupation is illegal, and the occupied peoples have the right to use force to remove the occupation. This is a basic tenet of international law. And so every minute that the United States remains occupying Iraq, which it occupied in a war of aggression, which is the supreme war crime under the Nuremberg precedents, meaning every American that took part in this war in Iraq deserves to be executed for the worst war crime there is. It's worse than genocide. According to Nuremberg, the worst crime that Germany committed during World War II was launching a war of aggression. And that precedent held up until the false flag events of September 2001. Since then, the United States has launched several totally unprovoked wars of aggression, including the war against Iraq, based on the false pretenses of so-called weapons of mass destruction that didn't even exist. The Iraqi people have heroically resisted this invasion and occupation, and indeed genocide. There's the book Genocide in Iraq that details how the U.S. invasion of Iraq has actually met the definition of genocide under international law. So the Iraqi people have been resisting from the very day that the Americans first landed, and they're continuing to resist now, and they're ramping up their resistance, and they are right under international law, and the Americans are wrong.
The Yemeni army says it has conducted retaliatory drone strikes on targets inside Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sariya said two Qasif 2K drones attacked the King Khalid Air Base in the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis al-Mushayyad. He added that in a separate attack, a Samad drone targeted a facility belonging to Saudi Arabia's oil company Aramco in the Jizan province. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have escalated retaliatory attacks in recent months. They are pushing for the lifting of a blockade and the cessation of aggression that has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. And meanwhile, 6 years of war on Yemen has had devastating impacts on the health sector of the poor country. Kidney patients are amongst the most affected segments in Yemen amid the closure of many dialysis centers due to the lack of fuel and medicine. Our correspondent Abdul Latif al-Washari has more in this report from the Yemeni city of Hodeidah.
A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeidah in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week, and a number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Hodeidah.
Meanwhile, at least seven people are injured as Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Clashes erupted near the Old City where Palestinian protests were protesting against an Israeli ban on their access to a promenade where they usually get together after breaking their fast during the Muslim month of Ramadan. The latest scuffles came after videos posted online showed Palestinians being harassed Wednesday night by Jewish youths shouting, quote, death to Arabs. Syria condemns the latest Israeli missile attacks on its territory, describing them as a clear violation of the 1974 agreement on disengagement. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the United Nations to condemn the move and the repeated violations of the country's sovereignty. The ministry urged the UN General Secretary and the Secretary Council to assume their responsibilities under the UN Charter in maintaining international peace and security. The reaction came after the Israeli regime carried out missile strikes near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Israel has repeatedly carried out strikes against Syria over the past years. The Israeli regime says a missile fired from Syria has exploded near its Dimona nuclear site. This comes 2 days after a powerful explosion jolted the central Israel. Here is a report.
On Tuesday, a powerful explosion rocked a sensitive military factory in central Israel. The blast near the town of Raml sent up a massive plume of fire and smoke, which could be seen from miles away. Israeli sources said the incident happened during a routine test and caused no casualties. Less than 48 hours later, Israel again found itself under threat. The regime said a Syrian surface-to-air missile had exploded near the Dimona nuclear plant. Tel Aviv said the Syrian missile was fired toward one of its aircraft over the Golan Heights, but it overflew its target and landed in Israel. Following the explosion, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, admitted that the regime's missile system failed to intercept the anti-aircraft missile. Gantz said an investigation has been launched into the failure of the so-called Iron Dome at stopping the projectile. Commentators believe that the incident further highlighted Israel's vulnerability.
This shows how Dimona, which is actually one of the most sensitive spots of the in occupied territories, is vulnerable. none of the, defense system, either Iron Dome or either any other defense system of the Zionist regime, have been booked there. And they were actually infiltrated by these rockets that were fired from the Syrian side.
U.S. media reports said the incident points to a possible Iranian involvement. Israeli media also said that anti-missile system around Dimona plant had been on high alert following the act of sabotage at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility earlier this month. However, Iran has not yet commented on the recent events. The incidents come at a time when Israel continues with its belligerent policies in the region. Tel Aviv has conducted hundreds of airstrikes on Syria over the past years. The regime has also been violating Lebanon's airspace on an almost daily basis. Despite all of this, the regime has met little international backlash. Syria and Lebanon have time and again called on the international community to hold Tel Aviv to account, but to no avail. Israel has never disclosed its nuclear arsenal, and it does not allow international inspections of its nuclear sites. But the regime's possession of nuclear weapons is an open secret. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Tel Aviv was in possession of at least 150 nuclear warheads.
The United States has more than 12,000 nuclear weapons, and the Soviet Union has about the same. And as you know, Great Britain and France have several hundred, and Israel has 150 or more.
With warmongers ruling in Tel Aviv taking provocative actions on a near daily basis, the region resembles a tinderbox. Following the recent incidents, the regime now has good reasons to think twice that any escalation and miscalculation could turn into an open confrontation in the region.
Turning elsewhere, hundreds have attended the funeral of African-American Donte Wright, who was fatally shot by a white policewoman in the U.S. state of Minnesota. Top state politicians and relatives of George Floyd, another black man killed by the Minnesota police, attended the service. The 20-year-old was laid to rest following a public viewing of his casket. Civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton made a speech at the funeral, slamming what he called the stench of racism in the U.S.
Well, we come today as the air fresheners for Minnesota. We're trying to get the stench of police brutality out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racism out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racial profiling out of the atmosphere. We come to Minnesota as air fresheners because your air is too odorous for us to breathe. We can't breathe in your stinking air no more.
Sharpton said the police must understand they aren't above the law. Wright was shot at a traffic stop in Brooklyn Center on April the 11th. The police say the officer mistook her handgun for a taser. The black man's death was one of in a growing list of instances where African Americans are being killed at the hands of white police officers. The death of Floyd in Minneapolis in May last year sparked a wave of protests against police brutality and racial profiling in the U.S. Former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg says a reform of police is needed in the U.S. as the way African Americans are policed is different from that of whites.
The President said, we've heard, the Attorney General said, we've heard people all across America, from, you know, leaders to politicians to news people, everybody has recognized the fact that it has been here. And me, with 32 years of, you know, in law enforcement, having seen the issues across the board, having worked with departments all across this country, from Chicago, LA, New York, on dragnet operations and everything else, I've seen the culture. The culture is a double standard culture, and it is a different culture when it comes down to how do we police in black neighborhoods and African Americans, and how do we police white and affluent Americans. So it is a double standard, and it is time that we really, really begin to say something has to be done on reform on police.
The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly approved a bill aimed at combating violence against Asian communities in the country amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
By passing this bill, we'll send a message to the country that should be all too obvious by now. Hate crimes will not be tolerated, and federal law enforcement will do everything in its power to detect, deter, and if necessary, prosecute crimes to the full extent of the law.
The legislation was passed 94-1. Republican Senator Josh Hawley was the only vote against the bill. It is the first legislative measure by Congress to boost law enforcement's response to increasing attacks on people of Asian descent. The bill would create a Justice Department position focusing on the issue and beef up state and local hate crime reporting. It now goes to the House of Representatives before being signed into law by President Joe Biden. The shooting of six Asian women in Atlanta in March focused attention on the issue. Attacks targeting Asian Americans, especially women or older people, increased by nearly 150% in the past year. Russia's defense minister says he has ordered troops participating in the military drills in the Crimea region to return to their bases from Friday.
I instructed the commanders of troops and military districts to plan in detail the return of the troops to their permanent deployment points.
The minister said the Russian troops demonstrated their ability to ensure the reliable protection of the country. The military exercises, which involve tens of thousands of troops and dozens of warships and aircraft, have raised tensions between Moscow and Kiev, along with its Western supporters. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky welcomed the end of the war game, saying it could lead to reduced tensions exacerbated along the two countries' borders in recent weeks. NATO also said Russia's troop withdrawdown from areas near Ukraine border is important and timely, but the alliance would remain vigilant. That brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The senior county prosecutor in Indianapolis said on Monday, 19th of April, that his office never sought to invoke a law that could have prevented Brandon Scott Hull from buying two firearms before he shot and killed eight people last week at a FedEx packaging warehouse. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Campbell Robertson. The piece is titled, Authorities Did Not Try to Use Red Flag Law for Indianapolis Gunman. Stay with us for more of Campbell Robertson's article. Senior county prosecutor in Indianapolis said on Monday, 19th of April, that his office never sought to invoke a law that could have prevented Brandon Scott Hull from buying two firearms before he shot and killed eight people last week at a FedEx packaging warehouse in Indianapolis. In a news conference, Ryan Mears, the prosecutor for Marion County, said his office had decided not to use Indiana's so-called red flag law last year, even though Brandon Scott Hall's mother warned about her son's mental instability, had prompted the police to seize a shotgun from him. The tight deadlines and constraints on evidence gathering built into the state's 16-year-old statute gave prosecutors too little time to make a convincing case to a judge, Ryan Meir said, adding that losing in court could have backfired. If we move forward with that proceeding and we lose, guess what happens? The firearms goes right back to that person, he said. We weren't willing to take that risk. The tragedy of last week's mass shooting and the questions about missed opportunities in the months that led up to it has highlighted some shortcomings in the red flag laws adopted in more than a dozen states that have been one of the few gun control measures both political parties have been able to agree on. Under such laws, the authorities can take guns from people who are deemed by a judge to present a danger to themselves or to others, and bar those people from buying guns for a period of time. If Brandon Scott Hall had been subject to such a determination after his mother contacted the authorities in March of 2020, he would not have been able to legally purchase two rifles, a Roger AR-556 and an HM Defense HM-15F. A few months later, the semi-automatic weapons he would use to open fire on the workers in a packaging warehouse on Thursday night before fatally shooting himself. But as effective as the red flag laws may be in certain respects, such as preventing gun suicides, the new revelations about the handling of Brandon Hall's case last year show that the laws may fall well short in preventing the most horrific acts of gun violence. I think people hear red flag and they think it's the panacea to all these issues, Ryan Meir said in the news conference. It's not. What it is, it's a good start, he said, adding that because of a number of loopholes in the practical application of this law, the authorities do not always have the tools they need to make the most well-informed decisions. In Brandon Scott Hall's case, prosecutors considered his immediate mental health crisis. His mother told them he had talked of killing himself to be the priority, and after his gun was taken away, they considered the crisis averted. Research has shown that red flag laws do prevent gun suicides, and some of those who have studied gun violence say that suicide prevention should be seen as the primary purpose of such laws. Kendra Paris, a lawyer in Florida who has fought against risk protection orders, as red flag laws are legally described, said law enforcement officials have not had much success predicting who was capable of mass violence. The idea that we're going to fix this with RPOs at the state level, Kendra Paris said, it strikes me as folly. Even when authorities or individuals have gone to court to keep someone from keeping or acquiring guns, the efforts have not always been successful. In some cases, the courts of law have denied their petitions. In other cases where authorities initially won restrictions, the targets have later regained their ability to own weapons in follow-up hearings. One man in the Seattle area who wrote violent messages online, one of them was "kill all women," got his guns back after arguing before a judge that the messages were simply jokes. Jeffrey Swanson, a professor in psychiatry at Duke University School of Medicine, who has researched risk protection laws in various states, said Indiana's version was not the star example, marred by what he considered deficiencies in both due process and ineffectiveness. But he emphasized that any law should be part of a larger legal framework needed to prevent gun violence. Professor Jeffrey Swanson said, people say, Well, what's the one thing you should do to stop gun violence? Well, it's not a one-thing problem and not a one-thing solution. In our country, this is a whole puzzle with lots of different legal tools that can work together. Indiana's red flag law, named after Timothy Laird, a police officer known as Jake, who was killed in the line of duty back in 2004, is one of the oldest such laws in the country. Under the statute, a person is considered dangerous if he or she presents an imminent risk to oneself or to others, or presents a more general risk but fits certain other criteria, including unmeditated mental illness or a documented propensity for violence. Ryan Mears said his office had filed 8 petitions this year involving Laird law cases. All are still pending. The Indianapolis police said on Monday, 19th of April, that they recovered 191 guns last year through Laird law cases. Law enforcement learned of Brandon Scott Hall on 3rd of March 2020, when his mother and sister showed up at a police roll call, according to police records. Brandon Hall's mother told police officers that her son was having suicidal thoughts, potentially wanting to attempt suicide by cop, said the chief of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, Randall Taylor. Several police officers came to her house and took Brandon Scott Hall to a hospital for a temporary mental health hold. According to Ryan Mears, Brandon Scott Hall's hospital stay was measured by hours and not days, and no follow-up medication was prescribed. Had he been involuntarily committed under a judge's order after a hearing, he would have been barred from possessing a firearm under federal laws. Still, Dr. Swanson said nearly 24 states have laws that automatically impose some temporary gun restrictions even after shorter mental health commitments. This kind of statute, rather than the more well-known red flag laws which generally require a full court hearing and a judge's order, could potentially have been a more useful tool in preventing Brandon Scott Hall from buying more guns, he said. It is not entirely clear if this kind of law would have applied in Brandon Scott Hall's case, but Indiana has no such laws anyway.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and here is some food for thought in this blessed month of Ramadan for stimulating our minds. Once Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, heard a woman who was fasting swear at a maidservant. He ordered food to be brought and told her to eat. She said, "I am fasting, O Messenger of Allah." He said, "What kind of fast is it when you swear at your servant? Fasting is not just refraining from food and drink. Indeed, God Almighty has made the fast a restraint from all ugly conduct and evil speech, which break and invalidate the fast. How few are those who really keep their fast, and how many are those who just remain hungry?"
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
داریم آقا ماه رمضان آدم روزه میگیرتش اچوسا نسبت به دوروبریای خودش تون میشه.
Sometimes during the month of Ramadan, fasting takes away our energy and we become angry. We might lose our control toward our family members or close friends. This is because we are not in habit of fasting every day of the year, so we may lose our temper more especially at the beginning of the month of Ramadan. We have to take care of our temper because we might be under more pressure compared to the ordinary days.
من حسن منكم في هذا الشهر خلقه كان له جواز على الصراط.
The Holy Prophet of Islam in his Sha'baniya sermon states, if someone is good-tempered during month of Ramadan, he will pass the Sirat bridge in the other world fast. On the day when many people slip on their path towards heaven, the good-tempered people during Ramadan will pass this path easily. It is probable that upon not controlling our anger, we might be punished harshly, both in this world and the hereafter. Therefore, if we want to be prosperous, both in this world and the hereafter, it's better to manage our anger, especially during the holy month of Ramadan. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket, selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop after the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at the marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artists reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artists that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Well, Alice says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand. The worldwide trends show people rapidly moving toward modern vehicles now, especially electric cars. But Parisians saw a very unusual kind of EV driving around the city, similar to the one people were using over a century ago. A replica of the 1881 vehicle by French inventor Gustave Trouve was made to celebrate what is regarded as the 140th anniversary of the first viable electric car. Trouve, who is believed to have driven the world's first electric car, combined a rechargeable battery and a cycle, something very similar to a modern e-bike. The car has a motor to assist you, but you can still pedal at the same time.
So Gustave Trouve, when he combined an electric motor, a rechargeable battery and a cycle very similar to this one, that would be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, electric vehicle to be seen on the roads.
A Victorian cycle engineer built the vehicle in North Yorkshire, England. It took him some 2 months to come up with the replica with materials that closely matched those used by Trouve himself. Like the original, it has an average speed of approximately 16 kilometers per hour. NASA's small helicopter has made history as it successfully completed its flight on Mars. Receiving instructions from Earth, Ingenuity managed to rise to about 3 meters, hovered for 30 seconds, and then landed on the red planet. The mission marked the first powered, controlled flight on another planet. The helicopter weighs only 1.8 kilograms, has 4 legs, and is powered by solar panels. Flying a helicopter on Mars is hard because there is not much air to push against to generate the necessary lift. A creative artist in Belgium has come up with an alternative to the face masks, a portable oasis. Alain Vercheron says the mini greenhouse allows him to connect with people while observing social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic. However, the idea is not new. It came to his mind 15 years ago, inspired by the lush oasis he encountered while working in Tunisia.
An oasis is a place of calm, tranquility, cool and well-being in the deserts. Here, the fact of having an oasis containing medicinal plants means I am also protecting myself from harm coming from the outside, just like I could at an oasis in the middle of the desert.
Doesn't that look bizarre? Well, he says he has asthma, and breathing with the device is easier than a face mask. The 61-year-old artist hopes his invention also raises awareness of environment protection. Pumas are solitary animals that do not usually get along well with humans. However, a Russian family has been living with an extraordinarily friendly mountain lion for 5 years. Now, Alexander and Maria Dmitriev bought little Messi from a zoo 5 years ago. The cat could barely walk then. With the tender care of the couple, he soon regained his strength. Messi's growth was stunted due to his malnutrition. Interestingly, the adorable puma has never shown any aggression toward humans. Well, looks very friendly. Messi's family has converted their home to meet
his natural needs. They have also set up social media accounts for him on Instagram and YouTube, where he has millions of followers.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Malaysian farmers tap classical music and massages to grow one of the world's most expensive fruits, Japanese muskmelons. The farmers believe the method is the best way to grow Japanese muskmelons in Malaysia's hot tropical weather. They regularly rub the melons with a soft cloth or glove. That's a practice, the farmers say, enhance the melon's flavor. To stimulate their growth, classical music is played in greenhouses, and now all these efforts have paid off following constant trials. The farmers are finally selling their prized luxury fruits of labor on the market.
April is usually marked by multi-day festivities across much of Southeast Asia, including Myanmar, as they observe the Buddhist New Year. The traditional New Year in Myanmar this year began on Tuesday with five-day celebrations known as Tengyan. The occasion is usually celebrated with prayers, ritual cleaning of Buddha images in temples, and public water splashing on the streets. They think water can wash their souls and all evil deeds. People also flock to temples with traditional pots containing flowers and receive blessings from monks. But typically, joyous period of celebration is looking very different this year amid coronavirus and political crises in Myanmar.
A dozen lucky penguins have been returned to the wild after rehabilitating from malnutrition and anemia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Argentina. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists. Some of them had lost their plumage due to malnutrition, but they recovered their feathers after receiving special nutrients. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile. People in Britain are marking the easing of lockdowns implemented to curb the coronavirus pandemic. Words like freedom, hope, family, reunion, and relief have been projected on the walls of the UK's most iconic landmarks, as well as shops and department stores to show people's feelings. A British company commissioned a survey to find the words that best summed up people's feeling after months of lockdown began to be lifted on Monday. Those celebrating the event say reunion is the word that can best express their feelings.
The most powerful word in there for me is reunion. We've all been apart from each other, friends, loved ones, colleagues, who are also loved ones, I suppose, in some cases, and really looking forward to getting back to my friends and family that I haven't seen for a long time, and imagine a lot of the British public are too.
The event comes as the UK has been the worst hit nation with a pandemic across Europe. The country saw a staggering number of infections and deaths for months. This prompted authorities to impose restrictions in an effort to bring the pandemic under control. Japanese Olympics organizers have unveiled the game's iconic rings on top of Mount Pokhara, a popular tourist spot in the west of the Japanese capital, Tokyo. The unveiling of the rings comes as athletes around the world are ramping up training some 100 days ahead of the international event. The sad side of the story, however, is that the spectators are barred this time to accompany the organizers to mark and celebrate it. This is because uncertainties still exist over how and even whether or not the games will take place. A surge of the coronavirus infections, including in Japan, is playing havoc with preparations ahead of the Olympics. Many hope mass vaccinations would help hold the event. Suppose you have run out of milk and you're not in the mood to shop for shopping. This is for you. Robots are lending a hand with grocery shopping in Singapore. A technology company has deployed two robots to a neighborhood for a trial period. Both named Camilo, the machines deliver items from nearby supermarkets and online shops to around 700 households. Designers say people tend to use robots in the pandemic era.
Especially during this pandemic period, everybody is looking at, you know, contactless, humanless, because in the robot itself, it has its own disinfection UVC light that we could do disinfection after every trip is being made by itself.
The robots are equipped with sensors and cameras, and they can carry up to 20 kilograms in their compartment. Users can track the robot on its way using a mobile application. The smart machines make 4 or 5 deliveries per day.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
A U.S. jury has found former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of third-degree murder in the May 2020 death of George Floyd. The verdict was read in Hennepin County Court on Tuesday, 20th of April. As Black Lives Matter activists hit the streets to protest rampant police brutality in the United States, Derek Chauvin was found guilty of all the 3 criminal counts he was facing. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, "We Can Finally Breathe. Floyd's supporters react to guilty verdict." Please stay with us for more of the article by the Reuters news agency. A crowd gathered outside the downtown Minneapolis courtroom and held celebration as sacked Minneapolis policeman Derek Chauvin was convicted of the murder of George Floyd. As Selena McKnight stood outside the Hennepin County Government Center, she said, "We can finally breathe." Nervous crowds awaited a verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin, erupted in jubilation on Tuesday, 20th of April, after a jury found a former Minneapolis police officer guilty of murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd during an arrest last May. Throngs gathered in George Floyd Square around the intersection where George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died with his neck pinned to the street under Derek Chauvin's knee, screamed, cheered, and applauded at the news of the guilty verdict. Minnesota resident Gabriel Ijo said he was in disbelief at the verdict. He said, "I don't think it's hit me quite yet, but I'm overjoyed. I'm happy because this morning I didn't have any hope that this man was even going to go to jail, and I found out that he got all three counts. I thought it was just going to be manslaughter, if anything, so I'm happy is one emotion for sure." The square has become a place of protest since George Floyd's death made him the face of a national movement against racial injustice and police brutality. Protests against his killing swept the United States and the wider world last year in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. A 12-member jury found Derek Chauvin, 45, guilty of all three charges against him, second and third degree murder and manslaughter, after deliberating for just over 10 hours in a trial that encompassed 3 weeks of testimony from 45 witnesses. Derek Chauvin was quickly led away from the courtroom in handcuffs after the verdict was read. Kimberly Bernard from New York said that the verdict makes the Black Lives Matter movement unstoppable. She said, "This is a message to every little black child coming up that your life matters. And if your life is taken at the hands of the state, there will be consequences. And I hope every killer cop is watching and paying attention, because today the Black Lives Matter movement served notice on you." Legal experts say Derek Chauvin will likely seek to overturn his murder and manslaughter convictions by arguing that the jury was prejudiced by media coverage and a settlement in the civil case brought by George Floyd's family, though his odds of success are slim. He faces up to 40 years in prison for second-degree murder, up to 25 years in prison for third-degree murder, and up to 10 years for second-degree manslaughter. In recent days, more than 3,000 National Guard soldiers, along with police officers, state police, sheriff deputies, and other law enforcement personnel, have flooded the city. After closing arguments, the jury began deliberations on Monday afternoon, 19th of April. Derek Chauvin placed his knee on George Floyd's neck whilst he pleaded, "I can't breathe." Many activists have noted the conviction should not be represented as a panacea for structured racism, riddling the law enforcement and justice system. Minnesota's Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, reacted to the outcome of the trial. Jaylani Hossein, CARE Minnesota's executive director, said, "Whilst today's verdict is encouraging, it does not diminish the urgency with which we must continue our efforts to combat the epidemic of police violence in our communities." The statement added, "George Floyd received justice today in that courtroom. Now we must continue advocating for justice for all, everywhere. In the legislature, where we are fighting to pass bills to increase police oversight and end qualified immunity. In our own communities, where we come together to heal and build trust and mutual understanding. And in the streets, where every day we are organizing, marching, and strengthening our movement." Gravel Institute, in a tweet, said, Derek Chauvin is only the sixth police officer to have been convicted of murdering someone whilst on duty in the last 15 years. There are thousands of Derek Chauvins out there still working as cops. Former President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama said the jury did the right thing. The Obama said